This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Gone World by Tom Sweaterlich. Read for you by Brittany Presley. If I've heard correctly, all of you can see ahead to what the future holds, but your knowledge of the present is not clear. Dante, Inferno, Canto 10. Prologue. 2199. She had been warned she would see things her mind wouldn't understand. In a dead forest. In winter. Never-ending winter. The trees blackened from old fire and coated with ice. Several trunks toppled. A lattice of charred sticks. Climbing across the field of dead pines for hours. But her spacesuit kept her warm. A thin profile suit that allowed her a range of motion to keep moving. The spacesuit was orange, the color for trainees. This was her first excursion to a far future Earth. Everywhere she looked, in every direction, she saw the frost-blanched sky and the snowy ground cross-hatched by fallen trees. There were two suns. The pale disk of the sun she knew, and the garish white radiance of the phenomenon her instructor had called the white hole. This was once West Virginia. She had ranged far from base camp, and grew worried about finding her way back to the quadlander in time for extraction. A dosimeter measured her amount of radiation exposure, a color blotch that had dimmed over the past few hours from bright green to a green the color of pond scum. She had become infected by this place. The air and soil here polluted by a vapor of metal. Particles, minuscule enough to pass through her suit, into her body. QTNs, her instructor had called them. Quantum tunneling nanoparticles, he had said. She had asked her instructor if QTNs were like a swarm of robots, but he said to think of them more like cancer, that they'd house within the microtubules of her cells, and once enough of them had taken residence within her, she would be lost. Not death, he elaborated. Not exactly. He told her that she would see what QTNs do with human bodies, but that her intuition might reject what she was seeing, that she might be filled with revulsion, that she might feel a violent need to unsee. One of the burnt trees still stood, a barren pine whitened by a skin of ash, and when she passed the burnt white tree, the landscape changed around her. She was still in the forest, in winter, but the trees were no longer burned, fallen. The pines were lush now, green though snow-covered. Ice bent the boughs of distant pines vague through the scrim of snow. How did I get here? She looked behind her. No tracks, not even her own. I'm lost. She pushed through branches and needles, exhausted from the effort of lifting her steps from the drifts. She passed another burnt white tree, identical to the first she had seen. Dead. Its ashen branches skeletal. Or was it the same tree she had passed? I'm turned around, she thought. Clambering over roots and stones, sliding down snow, trying to find something familiar, some land feature she could recognize. She pushed through a gap between pines and came to a clearing, to the shore of a black river. She screamed when she saw the crucified woman. The woman had been crucified upside down, but there was no cross. She was suspended midair, hovering above the black water. Fire burned at her wrists, her ankles. The woman's ribcage was stretched, protruding. Her body diminished, thinned to the point of starvation. Her legs were striated black with gangrene. Her face was livid, purple, a pooling of blood, and her hair, pale blonde, dangled low enough to touch the surface of the water. She recognized herself as the crucified woman, and she fell to her knees on the shore of the Black River. A trick of the QTNs, she thought. It was repugnant, this absurdity. They're inside me, making me see these things. Panic lurched within her at the thought of QTNs accumulating in her cells, her brain. But even so, she realized this was no hallucination, that the crucified woman was real. As real as she was, as real as the river and the ice and trees. She thought to cut the woman down, but was horrified to touch her. Her meter changed from green to mustard yellow, and she ran, activating her retrieval beacon, trying to remember her extraction point. But the forest surrounding the river was unfamiliar, and she was lost. She backtracked the way she thought she had come, buffeted by icy wind, slipping in snow. She passed another white tree, identical to the others. Or no, it must be the same. A burnt pine, its bark a carapace of ash. The yellow of her meter had darkened to the shade of reddish clay. No, 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 she thought, running again, ducking through a clutch of branches. The meter flashed brilliant red. Nausea swept over her and she collapsed, brought down by the heaviness in her blood. She crawled forward through a break in the trees and found that she had arrived again at the clearing by the shore of the Black River, to the scene of her crucifixion. But there were innumerable crucifixions now. Thousands of bodies hovering upside down along the length of the river. Nude men and women screaming in the light of two suns. What is happening? She said out loud to no one. Her vision dimmed. She gasped for breath. When she saw flashing lights in the sky, she thought she might be losing consciousness. But they were the lights of one of the Quadlanders, a module named Theseus. The retrieval beacon, she thought. I'm saved. The Quadlander bounced in the clearing before settling onto the ice. Here, she said, her voice weak. She tried to scream. I'm over here! Two men in slim olive spacesuits worn by the Navy scrambled out of the hatch, and she saw them approach the river. I'm here, she said. But the men were too far away to hear her. She tried to crawl from the tree line. She wanted to run to them, but she lacked the strength to stand. She saw the two men wade into the river, hip deep, and saw them pull the crucified woman from the air, cradle her. They wrapped the woman in heavy blankets. No, I'm here. I'm here, she said. But watched them carry the crucified woman, that other version of herself, on board the lander. I'm here, she said. Please. Her meter darkened to muddy brown. The next color would be the lethal shade of black. She closed her eyes, waiting. The mule kick of the thruster shocked her into consciousness, and she recognized where she was. She was in one of the Quadlander's pods, she realized, her wrists and ankles strapped to the cot, her head and neck secured in a padded block. She was numb, shivering, covered in blankets that were tied down at the edges. The G-force of their liftoff abated, and she felt weightlessness. Please, she said. Go back. I'm down there. Please, go back. Don't leave me.
You're all right. We've got you now, said her instructor, floating through the pod to her bedside.
He was a much older man, with silvery hair, though his blue eyes seemed young. His hands were leather soft when he checked her pulse.
Your wrists and ankles will be in considerable pain, he said. I don't know how you were bound, but you suffered burns. You suffered from the exposure. Extensive frostbite. Hypothermia.
You have the wrong body, she said, remembering that she had somehow seen herself in the orange trainee spacesuit crawling along the tree line. You have to believe me. Please. I'm still down there. Please don't leave me.
No. You're back on Theseus, said her instructor. We found you in the woods.
He wore blue athletic shorts and white socks pulled to his knees, an NCIS t-shirt, gray.
You're confused, he said. The QTNs are confusing you. They're in your blood. You have dangerous levels of them inside you.
I don't understand, she said, trying to remember, but her mind was sluggish. What's inside of me?
I don't know what QTNs are.
Her teeth shattered, her body shook. Excruciating pain raked her limbs, bright shoots of nerve pain, but her fingers were deadened, and her toes. She remembered stepping from her spacesuit by the river, shedding her clothes. She remembered ice burning her shoulders, blistering her. She remembered fire at her wrists and ankles. She remembered that she had hung upside down over that rushing black water for hours, for days, maybe. She had been praying to die when she'd seen herself appear through the pines.
I don't understand, she said, crying against the pain.
Our main concern right now is your hypothermia and frostbite, said her instructor,
floating nearer to her feet and peeling back the corner of the blanket to check on her.
Oh, Shannon, he said. Oh.
She lifted her head and saw that her feet were purple-black and swollen, the surrounding skin flaky and yellowed.
God, no. Oh, God, no, she said.
And in her shock, almost felt like these feet belonged to someone else, that they were anyone's but her own. Someone had placed pieces of cotton between her toes. Violet lines stretched up her left leg. Her instructor rubbed her feet with a damp washcloth, but she couldn't feel the water, even as it slid from the cloth over her toes and spun away like beads of glass through the air.
Your mind was affected. Your memory may have been affected by the hypothermia, he said. First Lieutenant Stillwell and Petty Officer Alexis rescued you, stabilized you here. You're not there anymore. You're here. You're safe now.
I don't know who they are, she said, their names unfamiliar.
First Lieutenant Rudiker had piloted the Quadlander, along with Petty Officer Lee. There was no Stillwell, as far as she knew. The bay window framed a view of Earth, distant now, marbled white with mists and ice. She wondered at her own body dying below in the wilderness, still in her spacesuit. But she could see that her spacesuit was locked in one of the pod closets, bright orange, like a hunter's blaze camouflage.
What the hell is happening to me?
Although her wrists and ankles were covered with bandages that smelled of ointment, she felt her skin burning as if she had been doused with acid.
This hurts, she said. I hurt so much.
We've let the medics know you're coming, said her instructor. They'll be ready to treat you once we dock with the ship.
What? What was down there? What happened to me? She asked. I was hanging. They all were.
You saw people who were crucified along the river, he said. I've seen them too, when I've traveled to study the Terminus. Many times. We call them the Hanged Men. The QTNs crucify those people. They crucified you.
You said they're in my blood. Get them out! Get them out of me!
Shannon, we've been through this. We can't get them out. We covered this in training. I thought you were ready. I warned you about them.
No, you never did, she said, fighting to concentrate through the pain, the throbbing burn in her wrists. Her memories were confused, muddled.
She remembered she had traveled to deep time on the USS William McKinley, to the year 2199, or one of an infinite number of possible 2199s, a distance of nearly 200 years. A pale radiance hung over the Earth when they arrived, shining like a second sun. The entire crew had been astonished. No one knew what that pale light was. No one had warned her about QTNs or the Hanged Men.
You said you were taking me home. That's all you ever said.
Shannon, said her instructor, helpless.
He rubbed her feet again with the washcloth.
I don't know what to say. The hypothermia, it can cause amnesia. Maybe as you recover.
Rendezvous with William McKinley. Prepare for docking, said a voice over the loudspeaker. A voice she didn't recognize. She remembered black water rushing beneath her. She looked again at her feet. Some color had returned to her right foot, but the toes on her left were still black, and the lines reaching up her left leg had darkened. The sight sickened her. What are they? What are QTNs? What's inside of me? She asked, rebelling against her bewilderment. I don't care if you think we've been over this before.
We don't know where they come from or what they want, said her instructor. They might not want anything. Quantum tunneling nanoparticles. We believe they are extra-dimensional. They come through the white hole, that second sun you saw, sometime in our future. They cause the event we call the Terminus.
The crucifixions.
The moment humanity ceases to be relevant, said her instructor. No one is left alive. Not in the conventional sense, at any rate. There are the hanged men, but there are runners, too. Millions running in great packs until their bodies disintegrate or they run into the ocean to drown. Some dig holes and then lie down inside. Some people stand with their faces toward the sky, their mouths filled with silver liquid. On the beaches, they line up and perform what look like calisthenics.
Why?
We don't understand why, or to what purpose. Maybe there is no purpose.
But this is just a version of the future, she said, imagining she could feel the QTNs like parasites in her blood. This is just one of infinite possibilities. So there are other possibilities, other futures. The Terminus doesn't have to happen.
The Terminus is a shadow that falls across the future of our species, said her instructor. Every timeline we've visited ends in the Terminus, and it's moving closer. We first dated the event to 2666, but the next travelers to witness the Terminus found that it had moved closer to 2456. And the Terminus has moved closer still, to 2121. You see, the Terminus is like the blade of a guillotine slicing toward us. Our Navy and its fleet have been tasked to find a way out from that shadow, and our vocation is to support the Navy. Everything I'll teach you, everything you'll see, is to help our species avoid the Terminus. We have to find our way out from the shadow.
What else will I see?
The end of everything.
Part 1. 1997. 1. Hello?
Special Agent Shannon Moss?
She didn't recognize the man's voice, though she recognized the drawl on the vowels. He'd grown up around here. West Virginia or Pennsylvania. Rural.
This is Moss, she said.
Family's been killed.
A quaver in his voice.
Washington County Dispatch logged the 911 a little after midnight. There's a missing girl.
2 a.m. But the news was like an ice bath. She was fully awake now.
Who am I speaking with?
Special Agent Philip Nestor, he said. FBI.
She turned on her bedside lamp. Cream-colored wallpaper patterned with vines and cornflower blue roses covered her bedroom walls. She traced the lines with her eyes, thinking.
Why my involvement? She asked.
My understanding's that our SAC communicated with HQ, and they instructed him to involve you,
said Nestor.
They want NCIS assistance. Our primary is a Navy SEAL.
Where?
Cannonsburg, on a street called Cricketwood Court, just off Hunter's Creek, he said.
Hunting Creek. She knew Hunting Creek. Cricketwood Court. Her best friend growing up had lived on that street. Courtney Gim. The image of Courtney's face floated from Moss's memory like ice surfacing through water.
How many victims are we dealing with?
Triple homicide, said Nestor.
It's bad. I've never...
Slow down.
I'd seen some kids hit by a train once, but nothing like this,
he said.
Okay, said Moss. You said the call came in after midnight?
A little later,
said Nestor.
A neighbor heard commotion, finally called the police.
Do you have someone speaking with the neighbor?
One of our guys is with her now,
he said.
I'll make it there in a little over an hour.
She gained her equilibrium before attempting to stand. Her right leg still the lean, muscled leg of an athlete, but her left terminated in a conical mid-thigh stump, the end muscle and flesh there wrapped like a fold-over pastry. She'd lost her leg years ago, when she'd been crucified in the deep winter of the terminus. A transfemoral amputation, the Navy surgeons having cut away the part of her that had gone gangrenous. When she stood, she perched on her single foot like a long-legged shorebird, rocking on the pads of her toes for balance. Her crutches were within reach. Lofstrand crutches she kept propped in the gap between her bed and nightstand. She slipped her forearms through the cuffs and gripped the handles, propelling herself through her bedroom, a cluttered mess of clothes and magazines, loose CDs, empty jewel cases, slipping hazards her occupational therapist had warned her against. Cricketwood Court. A shiver passed over Moss at the thought of returning. She and Courtney had been like sisters through middle school, freshman year, closer than sisters, inseparable. Moss's memories of Courtney were the sweetest essence of childhood summers. Endless days spent poolside, roller coasters at Kennywood, splitting cigarettes down by Chartier's Creek. Courtney had died their sophomore year, murdered in a parking lot for the few dollars she'd had in her purse. Headline news on the bedroom set while she dressed. She applied antiperspirant to her residual limb, then nestled her polyurethane liner against the blunt edge of her thigh, rolling it to her hip as if she were rolling on a nylon stocking. She smoothed the rubbery sleeve of any air bubbles that might have accrued against her skin. The prosthesis was an Autobox C-leg, a prototype, a computerized prosthesis originally designed for wounded soldiers. Moss slid her thigh into the socket and stood, the volume of her thigh forcing out air from the carbon cuff, vacuum sealing the prosthesis. The C-leg made her feel as if her skeleton were exposed, a steel shank instead of a shin. She wore slacks, a blouse the color of pearls. She holstered her service weapon. She wore a tailored suede jacket. A last glance at television. Dolly skulking in her hay-strewn pen. Clinton touting the newly signed human cloning ban. Promos for NBA on NBC. Jordan versus Ewing. Cricketwood Court was a cul-de-sac. Sirens flaring against row houses and lawns. A quarter after 3 a.m. Neighbors would know something had happened, but they might not know what yet. If they peered from their windows, they would find a confusion of patrol units, sheriff's cars and Cannonsburg PD, state police cruisers, investigations a web of jurisdiction by the time federal agents were involved. Moss's cases tended to concern Naval Space Command sailors, home on shore leave from deep waters, the black ops missions to deep space and deep time. Bar fights, domestic violence, drug charges, homicides. She had worked cases where NSC sailors had snapped and beaten their wives or girlfriends to death. Tragic occurrences. Some sailors spiraling after seeing the terrors of the terminus or the light of alien suns. She wondered what she would find here. The county coroner's van was parked nearby. Ambulances and fire engines idled. The FBI mobile crime lab had backed over the berm into the front lawn of her old friend's house. Jesus Christ. The house Moss remembered from her childhood was as if superimposed over the house as it stood. Two films playing concurrently. A memory and a crime scene. Courtney's family had long since moved from here, and Moss never thought she would set foot within her old friend's house again. Certainly not under these circumstances. A two-story end unit, the other houses in its row lined up like mirror reflections, each with a driveway, a petite garage, each front stoop lit by a single porch light, the facades identical down the line, brick topped by white vinyl. Growing up, Moss had spent more time here than at her own house, it seemed. She still remembered the Gim's old phone number. An oily sensation of one reality oozing into another, like a yolk pouring through a crack in its shell. She took a swig of coffee from her thermos and rubbed her eyes as if to wake herself, to convince herself that this coincidence of houses was real, that she wasn't caught dreaming. A coincidence, she told herself. There used to be a flowering dogwood in the front yard that had since been hacked down. Moss slowed her pickup at a sheriff's blockade, and a deputy approached her window. A middle-aged gut and chaplain-esque mustache that would have been humorous except for the weariness weighing in his eyes. He tried to get her to turn her truck around until she rolled down her window and showed identification.
"What is that?"
he asked. "Naval Criminal Investigative Service," she said, accustomed to explaining her agency's initials. "Federal agent. We're interested in a possible military connection. How bad is it?"
"My buddy was in there earlier and told me this is the worst he's ever seen. Just the goddamned worst," he said,
his breath stale with coffee.
"Says there's not much left of them."
"Reporters been around?"
"Not yet,"
he said.
"We were told some news vans are on their way down from Pittsburgh. I don't think they know what they'll find. Quiet otherwise. Come on through."
A lace of police tape cordoned off the lawn and driveway, stretching from a lamppost and looping around the house's wrought iron stoop railing. Some of the forensic technicians huddled near the garage, a smoke break. They watched Moss approach without the casual chauvinism or bald stare she sometimes encountered at scenes. Their eyes were haunted tonight, glancing her way as if they pitied her for what she was about to endure. The doorway was draped with a plastic tarp, but the smells of the house assaulted her once she ducked through. The cloying tang of blood and bright rot and shit mingled with chemical stenches of the tech solutions, the collection kits and ethanol. The odors seeped into her, a metallic tinge from the blood, her saliva immediately coppery as if she'd sucked on pennies. Criminalists in Tyvek crowded the foyer, busy with evidence preservation, photography. A nervous anticipation roiled Moss in the moments before her first view of a new crime scene. Once she turned the corner and saw what she was dealing with, however, her nervousness dissipated, replaced by an urgent and sorrowful compulsion to reassemble the broken pieces as quickly as possible. A boy and a woman lay on the floor, their faces smeared away in a mince of brain and blood and whorls of bone. Flannel pants on the boy, a jersey for a nightshirt. 10 or 11 years old, Moss guessed. The woman's nightgown was filthy with blood, her bare legs shading to plum where lividity had discolored her. Both had voided their bowels, the floor so sopped that shit and standing blood had pooled in the uneven runnels of the carpeting. The odors gagged her. The smells of the boy and his mother degraded them, she thought, their humanity debased by sewage stink and formlessness. Moss had long ago learned the dissociative technique of viewing bodies through different lenses, divorcing the mutilation as much as possible from the personalities they once were. Seeing her colleagues around her through the lens of humanity, seeing the bodies through the lens of forensics. Moss objectified the corpses. The killstroke for the woman had been one of two blows to her head, either to her left zygomatic or to the parietal on the same side. The woman's left pupil had dilated to a wide black saucer. Moss noticed that the boy's fingernails had been removed. All of them. And his toenails, too, it looked like. She checked the woman and found that her nails had been removed as well. Someone, a man, no doubt, had killed these people, then knelt in the gore to pluck their nails from them. Or had he taken their nails before he'd killed them? Why had he done that? One of the technicians ran lengths of thread from the blood spatter on the ceiling and walls, creating a web of thread that delineated an area of convergence. It looked like the victims had been on their knees when they were struck. An execution. The room they had died in was bland, tasteless. Nothing like the room Moss had once known, the comfortable cave-like rec room kept by her best friend's family. Oatmeal tones now. Track lighting. Nothing on the walls. No artwork, no photographs. The room didn't look lived in. It looked staged for resale.
Shannon Moss?
One of the men in Tyvek had paused in his work. Bloodshot eyes, nearly crimson, his dark skin ashen. Vapor rub daubed beneath his nostrils in twin, greasy streaks.
Special Agent, NCIS, she said.
He crossed the living room on stainless steel risers the investigators used like stepping stones over the blood. He chewed gum, said.
William Brock, Special Agent in charge. Let's talk.
Brock led her through the narrow kitchen, the few men gathered there no longer wearing their Tyvek, their shirts and ties rumpled from hours of work, their faces wan with sleeplessness. Brock, however, seemed tireless, like he would charge bullish until this killer was caught. Angry, almost scowling, as he led Moss, as if personally offended by what had happened here. He was sizable, his voice a resonant baritone in a room of hushed voices.
"Right through here, in this little den," he said,
pulling aside the flimsy accordion door of a room that branched off from the kitchen. The rest of the house had been soullessly updated over the years, but the den remained unchanged, seemingly untouched since Moss had seen it last. The effect was unnerving. Like this little patch had been forgotten when the rest of time had passed on. Faux wood paneling, a gaudy light fixture that cast the room in amber. Even the particle board desk and metal filing cabinets were similar, if not the same pieces left over. Courtney had once found a stash of letters in one of those cabinets that her parents had written as they were divorcing. The girls had sat on the front stoop and read them aloud to each other. Moss, struck by how earnest, how almost childish a grown man's letters to his wife could be. Nothing different from high school breakup letters, she thought. No difference at all. Nothing changes. The human heart doesn't age.
"Do we have pictures of the victims?" asked Moss.
"Anything recent? It's impossible to tell what they might have looked like."
"We have some albums," said Brock. "Photomat receipts and negatives. We'll get them to you once they're developed. Have you had a chance to see the entire scene? Upstairs."
"I'll need to see upstairs," said Moss. Brock folded closed the accordion door.
"I need to talk with you. Clear up a few things," he said,
taking a seat behind the particle board desk.
"The FBI's deputy director called me in the middle of the night, pulled me from bed. I don't receive calls from him on a regular basis. He told me there's a federal crime scene in Cannonsburg. Told me to lock it down."
"But that's not all he told you," said Moss. Brock bared his teeth, meant to be a smile, an easing, but it looked like a pained expression. He wadded his gum into its silvery wrapper, replaced it with a fresh black stick, licorice wafting on a cloud of breath. Moss noticed tooth marks on his pencil. Maybe he'd quit smoking, she thought, or was trying to. Early 40s, maybe mid-40s. Muscular. A regular at the gym, she figured. She imagined him sparring, a boxer. She imagined him running miles on treadmills in empty exercise rooms.
I'm struggling to understand what the deputy director told me,
said Brock.
To wrap my mind around what we found here. He briefed me on a special access program called Deep Waters.
Brock spoke the words like an incantation, a shadow of fear passing over his eyes.
A Navy program. A black project. He said our primary suspect, a SEAL named Patrick Mersault, is connected with the Deep Waters program. Part of the Naval Space Command, he's said to include Shannon Moss in the investigation.
The scope of the possible world had opened for this man just a few hours ago, thought Moss, seeing Brock struggle to believe the unbelievable. He'd been brought into the secrecy of Deep Waters. But how much had he been trusted with? Moss remembered her first dreamlike glimpse of sunlight glaring off the hulls of the NSC fleet in space, like a spill of diamonds on black velvet, a sublimity few other people have witnessed. She imagined Brock taking the phone call at home, imagined him sitting on the edge of his bed, listening to his superior describe what must have sounded like miracles.
Mersault was some kind of astronaut, said Brock, his jaw grinding his licorice. Deep space. I understand deep space. I can understand we've been farther in the solar system than has been reported. But I don't understand how. Quantum foam.
So he'd been told about deep space, but not deep time, thought Moss. Naval Space Command had a public face, had been involved in Star Wars under Reagan, line items in Department of Defense budgets along with the Air Force Space Division and NASA. But the bulk of its operations were closely guarded secrets. Moss had traveled to deep space, but she had also traveled to deep time. Had time traveled to versions of the future, not only to witness the Terminus, but for her criminal investigations as well? IFTs, these futures were called, pronounced like the word if, inadmissible future trajectories. Inadmissible, because the future was mercurial. The futures NSC traveled to were only possibilities stemming from the conditions of the present. She was prohibited against using evidence gleaned from a future to build a case for prosecution in the present, because the future she observed might not ever occur. Think of me as a resource, said Moss. That's why I'm here. That's why you were asked to call me. My division within NCIS investigates crimes relating to the Deep Waters program.
I don't know what to believe, said Brock. I don't know what to believe about Patrick Mersault, about a black ops space program. It all sounds... I don't know how much of this I'm understanding.
There's a missing girl, said Moss. She's our priority. The reminder of the missing girl focused him, the thought of something actionable.
Marion Mersault,
he said.
17.
Marion, said Moss. We'll find her. Let's start with tonight.
Locals were first on scene,
said Brock. Any fog of bewilderment dissipated now.
Pegged our person of interest right away as Patrick Mersault. Figured he killed his own family. Once Cannonsburg PD found paperwork suggesting Mersault was a sailor, they called the Reserve Center to keep the Navy in the loop. They ID'd him. Served in the Navy during Vietnam. He must have been just a kid.
What else have you learned?
Your supervisor forwarded me a fax about Mersault from the National Personnel Record Center in St. Louis,
said Brock.
Broad strokes about him. Redactions. Navy SEAL in the late 70s. Served with the Naval Space Command since the early 80s. Petty officer first class. But his record stops in 1983. Turns out this guy's been living off the grid. Everything under his wife's name. His official status is missing in action.
Moss thought. A sailor living off the grid? An NSC sailor MIA? A sailor lost to Deep Waters was a tragedy. But a sailor presumed lost, suddenly appearing like this, living off the grid, was a national security threat. We need to locate him immediately.
Can we find out anything more definitive about this guy?
Said Brock. I'll be working with my director, but NCIS is a civilian agency, said Moss. I have top secret clearance, same as you. But information about Deep Waters is on a need-to-know basis. Compartmented. We can only work with what the Navy tells us. Brock spit his gum into its wrapper, flicked the wad into the wastebasket.
Let's focus on what we know,
he said.
The actor woke his victims, gathered them together in the family room before attacking them.
With what? Asked Moss.
An axe, said Brock.
She imagined the woman and boy kneeling, the wet thwack, pulling the axe free and swinging again. The annihilation of the family as simple as splitting wood. Any reason to doubt Patrick Mersault did this? She asked.
None,
said Brock.
But he might have had someone with him. The neighbor who called 911 mentioned a friend of his, a guy who drives a red pickup truck, West Virginia plates. We're focusing on the truck, trying to find this individual. She described him as a nuisance, often blocked her driveway. The truck's covered in bumper stickers. Let's take a look upstairs.
Moss followed Brock from the den. He ducked a line of police tape, led her upstairs, a climb she'd made countless times trailing Courtney, whose room had been the first on the right. The twisting metal railing seemed to spin against your palm, a familiar feeling. Self-conscious climbing stairs now, the movement of her prosthesis vaguely stop-motion, motorized. Brock paused at the top stair, watched Moss climb. He seemed to be spotting her, almost ready to try to catch her if she were to rock backward or fall. Moss had grown weary at these moments of awkwardness, when people first realized they were working with an amputee, trying to puzzle out how they should treat her. What happened up here? She asked.
His 7-year-old daughter, Jessica, escaped the initial attack, said Brock. Ran in here.
Courtney's room. Brock put his hand on the doorknob.
I have 2 daughters, he said. 2 beautiful girls.
He opened the door, let Moss through. Returning to this room felt like curling back into a cocoon. She remembered coating these walls of pink called bubblegum 6th grade summer, slopping the roller from the tray, Courtney yelping whenever paint glopped from the ceiling into her black curls. She remembered puffing cigarette smoke through the window screen in the summer swelter, AC/DC on the turntable, Power Age until the record was scratched and couldn't play past the first few seconds of What's Next to the Moon. The room was lavender now, with a white dresser and a bunk bed. The Mersault girls must have shared this room. Zeppelin and Van Halen had been replaced with DiCaprio, Romeo and Juliet. But the room felt the same. Jessica Mersault's body was in the corner, near where Courtney's bed had been. The girl's nightshirt was shredded, her back gouged with a deep cut between her shoulder blades that flayed out like gaping lips. Poor girl. Poor girl.
Are you all right?
Asked Brock. Where are their nails? Asked Moss, her focus watery, but noticing that the girl's fingernails and toenails had been removed as well.
You've gone pale, he said. Do you need to sit down?
I'm all right. She wavered. Brock steadied her, a hand on her back. Thank you, she said, though still unmoored. A heat of embarrassment flashed through her. Pull it together, she thought. I don't know what's wrong, she said. I'm sorry. Brock shepherded her from the bedroom into the hall.
Listen,
he said, shutting the bedroom door.
A scene like this is hard for anyone to take, let alone if you aren't used to it. It's all right if you're a little weak in the knees.
I have to tell you something, she said. I'm having some trouble tonight. This is uncanny. I know this house.
Go on.
I grew up around here, said Moss. I practically lived in this house when I was a kid. My best friend lived here. Courtney. Her name was Courtney Gim. This was her room. I spent a lot of time in this room. Her bed was right over there.
No shit,
said Brock. I'm unnerved by this, but I'm all right, said Moss. When Nestor called and said the crime scene was on Cricketwood Court. She steadied herself against the wall. Touching the wall, she felt like she could tear this present world away and see her friend again. Be with her friend as if no time had passed. As if she could step into the old bedroom. The gone world. Slap bracelets and jelly shoes. Colored bands and Courtney's braces. We used to hang out in the woods behind these houses, said Moss. We'd share cigarettes back there. Sunbathing on lawn chairs. Sharing high life. Courtney's dad worked night shifts, so they had this place to themselves. Her mom living up in Pittsburgh with her boyfriend. Pot some nights when Courtney could score, but most nights just staying up too late watching TV. School the next morning with bloodshot eyes. They partied with the other girls on the track team some nights. Neighborhood boys some nights. Some nights, Courtney and Moss and whatever boys they'd picked up at the mall would get high and drink and fool around while Letterman played. Nothing too serious. Just petting and kissing and hand jobs. Late nights ending with the smell of hand soap and semen. Christ, I lost my virginity in the room down the hall, she said. Courtney's brother, Davy Gim. She could see his face as clearly as if she'd been with him just yesterday. A senior when she was a sophomore, when he took fistfuls of Moss's hair and kissed her, when he ran his hands under her shirt and unbuttoned his jeans and placed her hands on him, hardening in her hands, feeling his weight press on her and feeling him push into her. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
Let's get some fresh air, said Brock. Can you make it down the stairs?
I'll be fine, she said. I'll be down in a moment. Her first night with Davy Gim had been in the small bedroom at the end of the hall. More of a closet or nursery than a proper third bedroom. Knives that Davy Gim had bought from flea markets, she remembered. A poster of Christy Brinkley from Sports Illustrated. Lying on the creaking twin bed, his eager fingers searching beneath the elastic of her shorts, his wet breath heavy on her neck. Remembering the sound of his sleeping, lying awake as moonlight crawled across the swimsuit model. Moss waited until she heard Brock's voice from downstairs before she opened Davy Gim's old bedroom door. Stepping into his room was like stepping into the cosmos. Star clusters and the constellations of the zodiac bursting from the infinite darkness. She flipped on the light switch. Maybe a part of her expected to see the swimsuit poster and the collection of knives. But she found the room of a little boy instead. Walls covered with glow-in-the-dark star stickers. Foolish. Regretting what she'd confessed to Brock. Realizing she should have just kept her mouth shut. That she shouldn't have mentioned anything about this house at all. Unprofessional. A moment of weakness. She saw the room not as it had been, but for what it was. The room of a dead child. She found Brock outside. The lawns of Cricketwood Court were touched with frost, crystals feathering the windshields of parked cars. An upstairs light in a neighboring unit had flipped on. Where was Marion through all this? She asked. Has anyone seen her?
All the neighbors know who she is, but she hasn't been around, said Brock. Not since Friday. We're waking friends and family. Trying to track her down.
You mentioned that Mersault has a friend who drives a red pickup truck, said Moss. No one knows this guy?
No one,
said Brock.
Neighbors noticed the truck because it was often parked out on the street. But Mersault and his friend kept to themselves.
I think we should go ahead and create the Amber Alert, said Moss.
She might turn up, said Brock. She might be at a friend's house. We're checking everywhere.
Amber alerts were new, Moss reminded herself, not as familiar as they would become. It will help us, she said. Someone might have seen her. Brock checked the illuminated dial of his watch.
Moss, your office is at CJIS, isn't that right?
He said. CJIS was the Criminal Justice Information Services Building, the nerve center of the FBI. A newly minted campus, a crystalline oddity, nestled in the middle of nowhere hills just outside Clarksburg, West Virginia. An FBI building, but without a Navy or Marine Corps installation in the region. Moss's NCIS office was co-located there.
You live out that way?
He asked.
Out near Clarksburg.
That's right.
My wife, Rashonda's at CJIS, in the print lab. Maybe you've crossed paths.
You're Rashonda Brock's husband? Moss said. A few thousand with offices in the CJIS facility, but Rashonda Brock was well known. The deputy assistant director of the laboratory division. Moss's office was near the facility's daycare, so although she had never met Brock's wife, she saw Rashonda drop her daughters off most mornings, a flurry of kisses and hugs. I think I've seen some of your kids' paintings, she said. Brianna and Jasmine, right? Their name tags are hanging on a corkboard near my office. Purple dinosaurs.
Barney,
said Brock, smiling now, chuckling.
Everything's Barney the dinosaur. Brianna's room is covered with him.
Moss understood how Rashonda might fit together with Brock. Rashonda, always radiant, a plump woman, tall. She must feel a warm sense of satisfaction whenever she drew laughter from this serious man.
So you drove in from Clarksburg, thereabouts. That's, what, an hour? An hour and a half from here?
He said, fishing out a key card from an envelope in his jacket pocket. He offered it to Moss.
We rented a block of rooms nearby. Don't make the trip home to Clarksburg tonight. You'll need to be right back here tomorrow morning.
I'll crash for a night, she said, weighing the change in Brock's demeanor. He'd softened since noticing her prosthesis, since mentioning his wife.
Deep waters,
he said, glancing skyward, though cloud cover occluded any chance of stars.
My boyhood dream was to be an astronaut. My grandparents took me to see a rocket launch at Cape Canaveral. It was the most beautiful sight I'd ever seen until my daughters were born.
Moss had seen the flares of firelight streak across the dawn, rockets lifting and vanishing from view. It's always beautiful. Every time, she said.
Get some sleep,
said Brock.
My team will continue through the night. Progress meeting at 9 a.m. with everyone involved. And then we'll do the presser.
A desire to put distance between herself and that house prickled her shoulders, her spine, as she pulled away from Cricketwood Court, from Hunting Creek. The hotel Brock had booked was a Best Western nearer to Washington, Pennsylvania. But before picking up 79, she looped through the parking lot of the Pizza Hut that edged Chartier's Creek. Courtney had been killed here. November of their sophomore year. The Pizza Hut was as it ever was, unchanged since the last time Moss had swung through here. A brick building with a Quonset hut roof, two dumpsters around back, blue dumpsters illuminated by Moss's headlights. Courtney's body had been left between those dumpsters. Moss counted hours, nearing 33 since Marion Mersault had last been seen. Marion was 17. Courtney had been 16 when she died. Moss drove to the hotel, thinking of her dead friend, thinking of the missing girl. Fingernails and toenails missing from the bodies of the dead. Had Patrick Mersault killed his family? Where was he now? Moss kept her go bag in the trunk. Two changes of clothes and a toiletries kit, ready to travel at a moment's notice. She undressed in her hotel room, removed her prosthesis, removed her liner. A whiff of moist, pungent sweat knocked her awake for a moment. The shower was tricky without safety bars. but once the water had warmed, she sat on the edge of the tub and swung her leg in, sliding down the porcelain to sit on the non-slip mat. Hot water streamed over her. She washed her hair, using the full complement of shampoo, tried to wash away the smells of putrescence and blood. Without her crutches or wheelchair, she hopped across the hotel carpeting before slipping between the bed's crisp sheets, bundling into the comforter. With the blinds drawn and the lights out, the room was miraculously dark. Cold. She turned over to sleep but saw the bodies of women and children unspooling in great bloody arcs and flowering wounds. A rising disgust and hopelessness burned acidic in her throat. She thought of Marion. Still alive. Please still be alive. But she didn't know what Marion looked like, so her imagination filled with the image of Courtney Gim, and her mind raced to axe blades biting through bone and wounds that opened like mouths. Clammy, tossing against the mattress and tangled in her sheets, the smell of her prosthesis liner wafting over from across the room, sour. She sat up and fumbled in the darkness for the remote control. The local channels were all reporting about the family killed in Washington County, just outside Cannonsburg. Moss squinted as the growing television brightness stabbed her eyes. Aerial shots of the neighborhood roofs and film of the sheriff's blockade, the deputy with the chaplain-esque mustache hitching up his pants near the sawhorses. The Amber Alert was first broadcast nearing 5 a.m. Marion Tricia Mersault, 17, of Cannonsburg, Pennsylvania. An image sun-kissed and freckled, cut-offs and a tank top, her straight hair the color of coal. Moss's breath caught at the similarities between her friend and the missing girl. Casually beautiful, each with that long, dark hair. Moss had been trained in time travel, accustomed to reliving future events as they played out in the terra firma of the present. But this deja vu was something else, like she'd caught the world repeating itself. The house, the girls, like she had seen something she wasn't supposed to see. The repetitive mechanics of cyclical time. Or maybe the similarity between the girls was something more rare. Something like a second chance. She had lost Courtney, but she could still save Marion. Moss relaxed into bed, comforted knowing that people would be looking for the girl. That someone might already have seen her, might know where she is. Safe. Safe. But as she drifted off for only a few hours of sleep, Moss could almost feel the girl's body grown cold. 2. Listless after Courtney died, Moss just shy of 16. The Gims invited her to stand with them at the funeral home. An exhausting honor. Awkward, next to Davy in the reception line. Courtney, lily white from concealer, laid out in an approximation of sleep. Courtney had always said she'd wanted to be buried in blue jeans, but they dressed her in a crushed velvet dress with a high lace collar, necessary to cover what the makeup couldn't hide of the slash across her neck. The stillness of the body so complete, so unnaturally still, that Moss almost expected her friend to sit up, to somehow stir or breathe. Coming from the funeral home, Moss imagined that a version of herself had died and would be buried alongside Courtney. Despondent, isolated, uninterested in the new version of herself, the self who survived. She lived alone with her mother. Her father had abandoned them when she was 5. Friendly enough with her mother, but her mother was never around, either at work or at McGrogan's for happy hours that melted into long nights of drinking. Moss grew inward, every night escaping to her room alone with her expanding collection of records. The Misfits, The Clash, The Sex Pistols, The Pixies, punk albums she picked from vinyl bins in CD stores. Just lying in bed with her headphones in the dark, lost in soundscapes. Utterly wasted years, those remaining years of high school. Drunk on Jack and Cherry Coke, or whatever alcohol someone snuck in the parking lot at lunch. Vacant in her own skin, almost failing out of school, but not quite. Ready to just keep living at home if she had to. Ready to work at the same telemarketing firm her mother worked for.